Well, I'm going to recommend that you get the announcement of your class up on the Paradox's website as well as the Reason's website.
Oh.
That way, so yeah, they'll be happy to do that. So I can't imagine retiring at age 65. I mean, that just seems so young. So I mean, kind of like Moses is only hitting his stride when he hit 80. It's like, so. Yeah, I remember when I was in Japan, they actually changed the law because they had academics forced to retire at age 62. And it's like, hey, when you're hitting 62, you're just kind of getting started in your research stride. So Japan has now adopted the American style where at age 65, you become emeritus. It means you can keep your office and you can do whatever you want. So good situation. And I've seen that especially in astronomy. Astronomers never retire. I mean, they literally work to the day of their death. So, and I remember one young man, he was in his late teens. He started a research project that he knew would take 70 years to finish. And he finished it. So,
then he died.
So, I mean, he was looking at these stars that go around one another, and, you know, their orbit is very long. So he knew he was going to need 70 years of data before he could publish any decent results. So, you know, what's amazing to me, I've been posting all these really beautiful photos of nature on my Facebook page. Guess which one got the greatest number of likes? It was this one. I didn't even take it. My wife took it. It was this particular photo. But I think it was the caption. You know, Kathy's caption was, "I took this photo to prove to all the Hughes critics that he's outstanding in the field." So yeah, it broke the record for likes as well as comments. I mean, you just never know. But you know, going back to this one, Isaiah 45:18. I mentioned when I was here a couple. By the way, thank you all of those that helped with the messages I gave last week. And yes, we were talking. Even though I've been on the staff here for 39 years, it's amazing how many people I talked to last week that were meeting me for the first time and hearing me for the first time. And one late woman was especially excited to tell me, "Well, I'm glad you're speaking today because it was your book that brought me to faith in Christ." And so she was all excited and wanted me to sign it and everything. But thank all of you who helped at the book table. So this passage I picked out of Isaiah 45:18 kind of gives you a one-sentence summary of the text we're studying in Proverbs 8. So I've mentioned before, Proverbs 8 is one of those three major creation texts in the Bible that takes you through the content of the 6 days of creation. You know, Genesis 1 takes you through the 6 days in a chronological order. Psalm 104, Proverbs 8, and Job 37-39 also take you through the content of those 6 days, but not in a chronological order. Now, He did not create an earth to be empty, but formed it to be inhabited. Here's a question for all of you. Of all the animals that live on the continental land masses, which one dominates in terms of the total biomass, the total bioweight? What do you think? You know, in this particular photo, it's wildebeest. But what is really the dominant animal on our continental land masses?
Insects,
termites,
bacteria.
I'm talking animals. So. I mean, yeah, do you realize there's 10 times as many bacteria in your body, on and in your body, than there are cells that make up the human body?
Birds.
So, birds?
Algae.
Ants.
It's ants.
Ants.
Okay. Here's a question. How much of the total biomass on the land masses is made up of ants? Yeah, they're an animal.
Equivalent to the mass of humans.
Well, it's actually more than the mass of humans. Yeah, ants dominate. Yeah, I mean, we don't really know for certain, but we know it's at least 15% of the total biomass of the continental land masses is made up of ants, animal biomass. And it could be as high as 25 or 26%. So, you know, we're talking 1/5 to 1/4 of all the animal biomass being made up of these ants.
But that's on land.
That's on land. Yeah, ants don't live in the ocean. We're just talking about the land mass.
They said the whole world, including the oceans and the lakes.
Well, it'd be a much smaller percentage if you included, because you know most of the biomass of the planet indeed is in the oceans. That's why I said the continental land. So we're talking islands and continents, wherever you got land. 20 to 25% of the total animal biomass is made up of ants. Now, it didn't always be that way. Ants were rare on planet Earth until just after the extinction of the dinosaurs. Remember that big asteroid that hit the Earth in the Yucatan Peninsula, Mexico, 66 million years ago? Well, it was after that extinction event when ants began to become very abundant. Before the Cretaceous-Paleogene extinction event, there were a few ant species running around. But they were not very advanced and they were not very abundant. But once the dinosaurs were gone and the birds and mammals began to proliferate, ants did too. So for the last 60 million years, the ant population has been growing. You probably have noticed that in your kitchen, that the ant population is growing. But the number of different species also has greatly increased, yes.
You said 15 to 25% of the biomass. Is that including plants, or are we just talking?
No, we're talking animal biomass. Yeah, the plants obviously dominate, but we're talking the animal biomass. The ants come in at least 15%, and it could actually exceed 25%. The figures tossed around is somewhere between 20 and 25% is made up of ants. So,
what's the relationship? Why did they increase after the dinosaurs left?
Well, that's what we're getting to. A paper just got published in Geology this month that actually tells us why we need to be thanking God for ants. Okay, now ants get mentioned in the Bible. Anybody remember where ants get mentioned? Proverbs, yeah, Proverbs. Let's jump to that. Okay, here we go. Proverbs 6:6. Go to the ant, you sluggard, and consider its ways and be wise. I mean, how many of you parents have ever shown this to your children, right? You know, go clean your room. But look at this passage here. So, and the whole point is, I mean, ants really are hard workers. They're always working. You never see them taking a day off or, you know, really taking a coffee break. They're always out there. And so it's interesting that, you know, for thousands of years we've had this in the Bible. That, you know, consider its ways and be wise. And the whole point is ants really aren't wise, but they do things that make it look like they're wise. Here's verse 7. They have no commander, no overseer, no ruler, and yet these ants will store provisions in summer and gather its food at harvest. It's like they know winter is coming, and so they'll actually store up food. They prepare for famines. They know there will come times, even during the summer, when the food supply will drop. And so wherever there's an abundance of food, they will gather extra. And if you look at an ant colony, they've got all these storehouses for the food. And that's designed to help them when there is, say, a famine period. Now, for an ant, if you go a day without food, that's a famine. So they store food to take into account. And one reason why we got ants all over the place is that they store up an abundance of food during the summer to take them through the winter. So even if there's snow on the ground, there's ice everywhere, the ants are doing fine because of the fact that they will, you know, you see an anthill, you might think it's only a few inches, but your typical ant colony will go down 5, 6, even 10 feet below the ground. And this is, and where it's colder, they'll go deeper underground because they know winter is coming when there's going to be snow and ice. And so they'll actually move underground where the temperature is adequate. You know, it'll be above freezing, and as such that they'll be able to survive through the winter and all the food that they piled up. But when you look at this text, it begs the question, why are ants able to do this? I mean, this is not something you'd expect from an evolutionary perspective, that ants would have this. You know, is it in their DNA? I mean, ants are classified as eusocial animals. What that means is they're compulsory social animals. I mean, all of you in the class here, you're social by choice. the ants are social because they're programmed that way. So they're compelled to be social. And, you know, ants have these different hierarchical structures where some gather food, some are the soldiers, some are the reproducers, some care for the, you know, the newborn ants. They all have their function, but they all do it without a ruler, without an overseer. There's no command and control system. It just happens. And likewise, bees do the same thing, wasps do the same thing, and the ants. But we underestimate the degree to which these ants are ubiquitous. And that's kind of the question that was taken up by the scientist Ronald Dorn. Why are there so many ants on the face of the earth? I mean, you literally have ants everywhere except Antarctica. I mean, even the coastal areas of Greenland, you've got ants. You don't have them in the central area. So anywhere where there's not, you know, hundreds of thousands of feet of permanent ice, you've got ants. They're literally everywhere. And literally adding up to a huge amount of biomass. But the question this particular geologist asked, why so many ants and why so recently? I mean, it's only been in the last 60 million years that ants became abundant and diverse on the face of the earth. Why? And so what he did, he got a team together and began to measure the chemistry around the anthills. And so what he was doing is comparing the chemistry of what happens around an ant colony and the bare ground around the ant colony and a place where there aren't any ants for over 100 feet away. Now, that's hard to find. Usually, you know, you're going to have ants no matter where you go. But he found places where there weren't ants and compared the chemistry there. So, and by the way, some of these anthills are not tiny. So, yeah. And that's just the part that's above ground, okay? So, you know, there are lots of ants running around.
Is that in the U.S.?
No, that's not the U.S. You know, I've been to Africa 3 times, and you see these things everywhere. In fact, you can go out into East Africa, and you'll see these like about every 40, 50 feet. I mean, they're just... So that kind of gives you an appreciation. Yeah, maybe it really does add up to 20 to 25% when you're wandering around and, you know, these huge ant colonies literally are everywhere. So now that's typical of the tropical area because there's a lot more for them to feed on. But, I mean, hey, I'll bet you every one of you has got ant hills on your property. I mean, I know we do. We got several ant colonies in our property. And when the temperature goes up, they do everything they can to invade the home. And particularly when it gets dry, they're looking for water. So, yes.
What is that made out of?
This is made out of clay. And so what the ants have done is they've harvested clay to build this, literally, ant city. And, you know, we're talking millions of ants inside that city. And by the way, as I mentioned before, that's just the part that's above ground. But anyway, what Ronald Dorn did is he discovered that there are calcium carbonates and magnesium carbonates in the vicinities of these ant colonies that comes in between 50 and 300 times what you measure outside the ant colony. And so he did a little more research, got some people together, and discovered that ants are one of the biggest contributors to silicate weathering. Now, I've talked about silicate weathering in class before. Silicate weathering is basically the means by which our Earth is kept habitable in spite of the fact that the sun is getting brighter and brighter and brighter. Now, until this paper was published a few days ago, we thought the compensation was predominantly being brought about by plants in particular. I mean, what you see over the past 500 million years is that the plants on the face of the earth have gotten progressively more and more efficient in enhancing silicate weathering. Now, let me refresh you and then we'll get back to the ants. Okay, here's the problem of maintaining life here on planet Earth. Is that our star, and this is true of all stars, their brightness changes over the history of its burning time. Now, our sun given its mass, is capable of fusing hydrogen into helium, basically the hydrogen bomb mechanism, for 9 billion years. But the rate at which it produces energy changes over the course of its burning history. And so this is what it looks like. When the sun is really young, it's accumulating mass. Now, the brightness of a star goes up with a fourth power of its mass. So if the sun, during its birthing period, is experiencing a doubling of its mass, then that would make it burn 16 times brighter. Now, it doesn't double, but what happens is it accumulates about 20 to 25% mass during its formation stage, and that causes its brightness to more than double. And so that's what happens here. It more than doubles, and then what happens afterwards, it begins to lose the mass that it accumulated, and it loses it much more efficiently than it does right now, which causes the sun to become dimmer and dimmer. It partly explains the date for the origin of life. The date for the origin of life is right about here. Okay? And that's when the sun finally becomes stable enough that the changes in the brightness of the sun aren't going to immediately bring about an extermination event. But it's still losing mass here, so it continues to get fainter and fainter, and then it stops losing mass. Now, that's an exaggeration. The sun is losing mass today, but is losing mass at an extremely slow rate. And so the rate at which it's losing mass basically has no effect on the brightness or the temperature of the sun. Now, it will in the future, but right now it really has a negligible effect. But the reason why the sun gets progressively brighter over the course of the history of life on planet Earth is that in its furnace, where that's where it's getting its light from, it's fusing hydrogen into helium. And helium is denser than hydrogen. And so when you burn hydrogen and make helium, you make the core of the sun more dense. And when you make it more dense, that causes the efficiency of the fusion of hydrogen and helium to go up. So as the sun gets older and older, it becomes more and more efficient in its capacity to fuse hydrogen to helium. So the hydrogen bomb that's burning in the center of the sun basically gets hotter and hotter, or brighter and brighter with respect to time. So we have the brightness of the sun increasing between 20 and 25% since the history of life. Now, ordinarily, that would terminate life here on planet Earth, because if you were to increase the brightness of the sun even by 1%, that would be enough to generate what's called a runaway escape of the, or a runaway conversion of the water into steam. Because as the sun gets brighter, what that does is it causes more water to evaporate on the surface of the Earth. This works if you've got surface water. So if you increase the temperature, more water evaporates. But water is a greenhouse gas. You know, we worry about carbon dioxide, but water also is a greenhouse gas. It traps heat. So if you push more water vapor into the atmosphere, it traps more heat, which causes more water to evaporate, which traps more heat, and you get what's called a runaway, and soon there's no ice, there's no liquid water on your planet, it's all steam. And that winds up bringing about the end of all life. However, life has persisted for 3.8 billion years. Why? Because as the sun has gotten brighter and brighter, the greenhouse gases in our atmosphere have become less and less efficient in their ability to trap heat, mainly because we have a decreasing quantity of these greenhouse gases. So the early Earth had way more greenhouse gases in its atmosphere than it does today. If you go back to the origin of life, our planet was actually warmer than it is today. Why? Because our atmosphere was saturated with not only a lot of carbon dioxide and water vapor, but also a lot of methane. Now, the methane has dropped a great deal, but so has the carbon dioxide. Now, what I shared with you a few months ago is a discovery of how it is that the introduction of plants at different times throughout the history of life on planet Earth, where God steps in, removes certain plants, and replaces it with new plants, the new plants that replace the old plants are more efficient in drawing carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And here's a good illustration. This is Cathedral Peak in Yosemite Park. And what you notice, if you've ever been to that part of Yosemite, is that you've got trees growing in hard granite, literally right up to the top. I mean, well, not to the very top, but as you can see here, you've got trees growing very high up on that exposed granite. And that's the wonderful thing about these conifers, is they're able to take root, literally, and bare granite, split the granite apart. They're able to take advantage of the water that's flowing on there, and can take hold, but they wind up generating a chemical reaction. And this is the chemical reaction that takes place. I've been through this before, so hopefully I can speed through this and we can move on, since all of you are familiar with this chemistry by now, I presume. So, our continental land masses begin as chunks of silicates. And a silicate, that's SiO3, so it's silicon trioxide, and it'll be bonded to some kind of metal. This is an example for calcium, but it would also work for magnesium and all the other metals that you can think of. And so this is an example for calcium. So you've got calcium silicate, which is kind of the raw material, the kind of the landmass. You've got carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And what makes this reaction work is rain. It won't work unless you've got liquid water falling on the continental land masses. And so the liquid water falls on the continental land masses, and what happens is it causes a reaction where the calcium silicate is broken up into calcium, and you get hydrogen carbonate, and you get silicon dioxide, otherwise known as sand. But, you know, calcium is very reactive, and so what happens is you wind up with calcium carbonate, carbon dioxide, and water. Now what you want to notice is the water cancels off on both sides. So the water is simply a catalyst. So we get rain falling in this kind of land masses, it stimulates a chemical reaction, and what you notice, here's the net reaction. You start off with the silicate and atmospheric carbon dioxide, and you get calcium carbonate and sand. And what happens is you pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is taken from the atmosphere and is converted into calcium carbonate and sand. Now, that's a good thing for several reasons. Calcium silicate is not a very useful mineral, but calcium carbonate and sand are. Thanks to calcium carbonate and sand, we can have concrete, and if you've got concrete, you can have freeways and you can have skyscrapers. That won't work if all you got are the silicates. And so thanks to this reaction running for billions of years, we've got literally tons and tons of calcium carbonate and sand that we can exploit to build cities and to build our transportation systems. I mean, just in terms of the calcium carbonate, we're looking at about 75 quadrillion tons minimum that have been formed by this process. And, you know, limestone obviously is a very good building material, but marble also comes from that, as well as gypsum and, you know, the cements, etc. And here's an example in the case of magnesium. Now, what they found in this study of these anthills is you look around the anthills, you find a huge quantity of calcium carbonate and magnesium carbonate. Those are the two most useful minerals that we get from this particular reaction. And so what they're able to conclude from this is that ants play a crucial role in enhancing the removal of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Now, we used to think that this is all being done by the plants that grow on the silicates. And what we see over the past half billion years is half billion years ago, you really didn't have plants. You had lichens up there, but that was about it. But now we've got plants that are able to very efficiently enhance this chemical reaction. But now we're discovering ants do it even better than the conifers. So without the ants, we'd have a planet Earth that would be too hot for us to live here and enjoy. Yes?
That's probably an obvious question. So when God intervened and put these
plants, that was all before the end of the sixth grade.
All before what?
The end of the sixth grade.
Well, this was all going on in day 5 and day 6. Okay.
There are no new plants coming up at this point. Like, he hasn't created any new plants now, or because...
Oh, I think I know what you're getting at.
Wouldn't he be creating them?
Okay. When you read Genesis chapter 1, and it says, let the continental land masses, or let the land masses proliferate with plants, that's the first time these land masses proliferate with plants, which is why we took some time to study Psalm 104, because Psalm 104 clarifies what a lot of people have been wondering about Genesis 1. Is creation day 3 the only day that God creates plants? Not according to Psalm 104, where it says the property of all life to die off, but God recreates and renews the face of the earth. So the beginning, or the second part of creation day 3, would be the first introduction of plants on the continental land masses. But it's not when God ceases creating plants. He creates plants thereafter. So, for example, when it says, let the seas swarm with animals, that was beginning of creation day 5. But according to Psalm 104, God constantly replaces, or frequently replaces, the animals he creates with new animals that he creates. Same thing with the plants. And one reason why we can say God deserves the credit rather than some naturalistic evolutionary process, notice that the removal of plant species and the introduction of new plant species is exactly what you need to compensate for the increasing brightness of the sun. Which means only a being with a mind that knows what's going to happen in the future of the sun is going to know which life to remove and which life to replace the old life with. Well, what this paper is discovering is that apparently this is also true of the animals. Now, this is not the first time we recognize that animals play a role in enhancing silicate erosion. Let me take you back to the first slide I showed you. Let's see, where is it? Here we go. There have been papers out for quite some time making the point that these grazing animals, like these wildebeests here, cows, sheep, horses, they're all relatively new upon the terrestrial scene. Again, they're kind of like the ants. It's only been the past few tens of millions of years we've had these creatures. But they're pretty heavy animals, anywhere from 100 to 1,000 pounds plus. And they're tromping around the land masses, and when they tromp around the land masses, they enhance erosion. Any of you who have been farmers or know people who are farmers are, I'm sure, witnesses to how much damage, or to put it more positively, how much benefit they do to expose the silicates to more erosion. I mean, they leave footprints. They really don't care what kind of mess they leave. They just, tromp around. And people have recognized this is a factor in enhancing the silicate erosion, but what this paper is pointing out is nothing compared to the ants. The ants are a far bigger contributor. And so we realize God's not only fine-tuning the introduction and removal of plants to compensate for the increasing brightness of the sun, he's doing that as well with the animals. That's kind of what the fossil record looks like. As we move forward in time in the fossil record, the animals and plants we see on the face of the earth are progressively more and more efficient in enhancing this chemical reaction of pulling carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And so as the sun is getting brighter and brighter, our planet is maintaining a temperature appropriate for life. Now, I got more to say, but let me take a couple of questions.
Maybe I missed it, but what were the ants doing to enhance carbonate and silicate production?
Okay. You look at an ant colony, and you notice they'll take bare ground and transform it into a labyrinth of tunnels. They also are very good at making sure their ant colony is not flooded. I mean, that's kind of the amazing thing about these ant colonies is that literally go 10 feet underground. They get all these cavities and the tunnels, and when it rains, wouldn't it all fill up with water? Well, the ants, as it tells us in the Proverbs, they're, quote, wise. Now, they're programmed that way. It's not like they're doing that, but what they do is they'll build their tunnels and their interior caverns in such a way that when it rains, they don't fill up with water. And if you look carefully at, that I should have shown you some photos here. I got one from Africa that kind of shows a really big ant colony where it's got all these circles of dikes around it. And basically that's designed to prevent the thing from being flooded out in a torrential rainstorm. And so they've got this complex structure, actually little dikes all built around to make sure the water flows away and not down in there. But what that does is it takes this ground area and creates all these spaces where air now makes contact.
More surface area.
There's more surface area, and likewise, when they abandon their colony and go somewhere else, it'll get eroded away and water gets in. And so it's, you know, it's kind of what these conifers do, is that they'll go into the granite, and they basically create, because the roots will go into the granite, and it allows water to get exposed into parts of the granite. It's not just the surface anymore, but a much broader surface, and it enhances the erosion. Let me see if I can actually show you something here. Yeah, here you go. This one shows you some exposed granite. Now, what you can see here, I mean, you can climb this thing. I've seen climbers go up it, but at the bottom, it's kind of loose and rocky. Well, here's an example of fairly advanced erosion, where here are these towering peaks, but at the base, you've got huge piles of sand and gravel. And that's just because the mountain has been very efficiently eroded, not only by the conifers, but other plant tissue there as well. And so, yeah, go ahead. Okay, I'll take you one on one.
Not only do they have moats, but they have an intricate system, especially in drier climates, having like an umbrella has a handle that goes in a U. Their caverns go down and have thousands of U-shaped tunnels. And the bottoms of the tunnels are, they make up a unique kind of spit that drives into a waterproof surface, so they have puddles that end up at the bottom that they can drink from, and they're up in an area that doesn't get the water. So the water fills up.
Well, that's one thing that Ronald Dorn comments on, is that you've got ants everywhere where you don't have hundreds of feet of permanent ice. So you can go into a desert place and you got ants. What you have is a species of ants that deals with the very arid conditions. And so if you're in a desert area, it might rain only 2 days of the year. They collect that water. So what you're talking about is an ant species that actually builds their ant hill or ant colony in such a way that they can store the water. But by storing the water, they're actually enhancing this chemical reaction. Yeah, go ahead.
Are you at one of the answers to the question I had was a survey or study that was a paper that was released a few years ago talking about that ants was one of the most prolific reproducers. And they did a model that if you could kill all the ants and leave just one male and one female, within 2 years they could repopulate the whole group again.
Wow.
And the other part about being flooded is their tunnels do get flooded occasionally, and they actually are designed that they can actually encase themselves in a little bubble and survive a week underwater. Yeah, they're just perfect survivors.
Right. And so if you go into a rainforest, the ants there are doing very different kinds of building. And that's what's so interesting about these colonies. Wherever you go in the continental land masses, you've got different species building different kinds of structures. Yes.
Yeah. Our local little black ants are actually not local. They came from Argentina on a ship to San Pedro 150 years ago. Because the local natives are those red ants you only find today way out in the high desert. And it seems like the black ants have colonies that are closer spaced. At least, you know, when they invade the kitchen in summer, it seems like they have the yard fully covered.
Well, it kind of reminds me of what we heard here from Dave, is that you could kill all the ants off except two, and they'd be all back in 2 years. And I think we've all experienced that, right? You exterminate all the ants in your backyard, and within, what is it, days, they're right back there. Yes.
Does the waste stream from the, since they're so large, is their waste stream and the fact that they do navigate with a chemical dropping system, does that have an effect on the, they're dropping this all over the place? Is that,
okay.
I would assume there's a fertilization taking place as well besides.
Yeah. What got published in this paper is we know because of the carbonates that we're seeing around these anthills that they're very efficiently contributing to silicate weathering. Exactly how they're doing that is still being worked out. So the paper ends with proposals for additional experiments to actually figure out exactly why you're getting 50 to 300 times the quantity of carbonates in the vicinity of these anthills, and what are the ants doing? Now, I mean, there's some good guesses. The fact that they're building these structures with all these tunnels and airways and cavities, that's doing something. And the fact that they build structures to control the water entry, that's telling us something. But they're saying 50 to 300 times is not trivial. And therefore, this is going to be worthy of more research. The reason I bring it to your attention is this is kind of a breakthrough in the sense that we're realizing, okay, we've been giving all the credit to these flowering plants and these conifers, and you know, a little bit of credit to the grazing mammals, and we've overlooked the ants. And maybe because of the... In fact, what the paper concludes is we wouldn't have an ice age cycle today if it wasn't for the ants. That if we didn't advance, and you know, all this talk about global warming, I think we need to appreciate that over the past 2 billion years, there's only been 3 episodes when Earth has had permanent ice. One happened between 600 and 800 million years ago, where we had 3 or 4 ice age cycles that lasted a few million years each. Another one happened just before and just after the Permian extinction event, somewhere between 200 and 300 million years ago. And the third one, the only three in the last 2 billion years, is right now. For the last 2.5 million years, our planet has had permanent ice. Now, that's exactly what you want if you want to have advanced global high technology civilization. But the amazing thing is, our planet today has permanent ice with these rather dramatic ice age cycles at a time when the sun is so bright you wonder how there could be any life here on the planet at all. And so there's other reasons to explain why we have such a cool Earth in spite of the fact that we got this extremely bright sun. And what scientists are beginning to recognize, it's basically, well, I'm saying this, the Creator is pulling out all stops to make sure that we have the ice we need even when the sun is very bright. And, you know, so we have this brief period where we've got this permanent... I mean, 10% of our planet today, continental land masses, is under permanent ice. And literally, for 90% of the time in the past 2.5 million years, that percentage has gone up to over 30%. So, yes?
Why is it that the North Pole... ice melting, but the South Pole, and Antarctica, ice is increasing. Is that true?
That is true, and you know we're trying to figure out why. But part of it is because of the wobble of the rotation in the Earth's axis. I mean, I can tell that you're old enough to probably remember when they had these kids' toys where you had the spinning top and you pull the string on it and it would spin very rapidly. Well, if you actually watch it spinning, it would spin very rapidly, but the spin axis would do a very slow wobble. Okay. Hopefully most of you have seen that. If you're really young, you've probably never seen a toy like that.
I remember.
But that is true of any rapidly spinning body. And so our planet Earth, likewise, has this slow wobble. You say, how slow? Well, it's more than 20,000 years. But it is such that the wobble that's taking place in the Earth's orbit is such that during the winter time in the northern hemisphere, we're closest to the sun. Whereas in the southern hemisphere, you're farthest from the sun in the winter time. So because of where we are in the precession, the wobble of Earth's orbit, we have warmer winters than we'd otherwise expect and cooler summers, whereas in the southern hemisphere, it's the opposite. Now, I don't have a globe here, but if you can just kind of remember what Earth looks like and where the continents are, almost all the continental landmass is in the northern hemisphere. There's not much in the southern hemisphere. And by the way, this effect of being closest to the sun in the wintertime will have the greatest impact on your climate at relatively high latitudes. Well, again, if you can remember what the globe looks like, the continents not only are predominantly in the northern hemisphere, the continents in the northern hemisphere have most of the landmass at relatively high latitudes. I mean, if you look at North America, it gets wider and wider as you go north. And so you've got Canada up there at high latitude, but because of where we are in this wobble cycle, the climate is relatively benign in Canada. And the same thing happens for Europe and Siberia. But if you look at the southern hemisphere, yes, we do have continental landmass below the equator, but almost all of it hugs pretty close to the equator. There's very little landmass, if you don't count Antarctica, that's at high southern latitudes. I mean, you've got Patagonia, but if you look at South America, it's the opposite of North America. North America gets wider and wider as you go north. South America gets narrower and narrower as you go south, which means very little of South America is at high southern latitudes. And likewise with Africa. I mean, Africa stops at about 33, 34 degrees south, kind of where we are here in California today. And so there is no landmass below 34 degrees in Africa, which means that they're not going to be impacted by that much. It's basically just the south tip of South America. And by the way, if you're to visit the south tip of South America, it's quite a harsh climate situation. And and that will change in another 13,000 years. But right now, what we have is a situation where you're going to get ice buildup in Antarctica, but you're not going to get the ice buildup in North America because where we are in that wobble cycle. There's a reason why God put us here at this particular time. We're the beneficiaries of these multiple ice age cycles. I mean, there's been, a good dozen ice age cycles of 100,000 years. By the way, before that, there were 41,000 years. Say, what's driving that? Something called the Milankovitch cycles. Say, what is that? Well, Milankovitch was a Serbian geophysicist that discovered that the ice ages are being driven by variations in the orbit of the Earth. And so the shape of our orbit as we go around the sun is basically on the ellipse. But the ellipse becomes more extreme every 100,000 years. And when it becomes more extreme, the planet cools down. And right now we're in that area where it's not extreme, and so our planet is warmed up. That's the 100,000-year cycle. The 41,000-year cycle is the tilt of our rotation axis. Our orbit around the sun varies a little bit, so sometimes our rotation axis tilt is 22 degrees, other times it's 24.5 degrees. And when it shifts towards 24.5 degrees, you get a cooler. Well, what happens is, you wind up with a colder winter, and with a colder winter, you build up more snow. That snow becomes ice, and it accumulates. And so that basically explains why we have this 2.5 million years where we got these regular ice age cycles, starting with 41,000 years, then transitioning to 100,000 years. And the reason why you get the transition, you got three cycles. You got the wobble, you got the change in the tilt of the rotation axis, and you got the change in the shape of the Earth's orbit. And so it's a rather complex interaction. But we wouldn't be having these cycles of ice if it wasn't for the ants. So when you go home today and cook dinner for your family, you might want to thank God for the fact that we live in a planet where ants are everywhere. So
when you kill ants, they're contributing to global warming.
When you kill ants, they're contributing to global warming.
We're getting near the end, so no more questions or comments. Let you wrap up the topic, please.
Okay.
Anyway, this all fits into our text. That's why I brought it up. But yeah, isn't it amazing that for years and years we've overlooked the ants and how they contribute to the climate? And by the way, it's a whole other story why we need so much ice. It's something else you can go home and thank God for when you have your meals, the fact that we live in an era in the history of the Earth where we have these very big cyclical ice age phenomena going on. It creates all the lakes. I mean, we'd be in trouble if we didn't have so many lakes. By the way, do you know that Canada's got more lakes than the rest of the world combined? That's because of the last ice age. All of Canada was under ice. By the way, parts of Alaska were not under ice. The last ice age only covered about one third of Alaska, but it covered every bit of Canada with the thick ice. And as probably you're aware, the last ice age made it all the way down here into California. Made it all the way down to Yosemite. That's kind of the southern border of the ice. But that's one reason why we got this great harbor in San Francisco. If it wasn't for the last ice age, we wouldn't have that nice harbor. So, just one of many reasons. And incidentally, ice covers all of Antarctica, covers almost all of Greenland. Here's a trivia question for you. Where is the third greatest pack of ice on planet Earth?
Patagonia, Argentina.
Believe it or not, it's quite close to the equator. The Tibetan Highlands actually has more pack of ice on it than all the other mountainous regions of the Earth outside of Greenland and Antarctica. And it's because of that huge store of ice over the Tibetan Highland that you can have India and China supporting billions of people. If it wasn't for that Tibetan plateau with all of its ice, you wouldn't have those mighty rivers flowing through the plains of India and China and supporting 2.5 billion people. 2.5 billion people are dependent upon the ice that sits on top of the Tibetan Highlands. And hey, it was only 20 million years ago when India first made contact with Southern Asia. And when it made contact, it brought up the Himalayas. And by the way, the Himalayas are still going up. And so something else you can thank God for when you have your meal today is thank God for how fast the Indian subcontinent collided with Asia. By the way, in the entire history of the Earth, we have never measured a higher rate of continental landmass movement than the detachment of India from Madagascar and moving north at a very high velocity, 15 to 20 centimeters per year. It moved north and hit Asia. And because it hit it so fast and hit it so hard, it pushed up these mountains literally to nearly 30,000 feet. And because of how high they are, you've got these huge glacial ice sheets covering that region of the world and supplying water to all these rich. And that's the other thing we notice about India. It's one of the richest soils that you can find anywhere in the world. But it was down at Antarctica at one time, split off from that, and then Antarctica, then headed north at a rapid speed and collided with Asia. And incidentally, that collision is going to keep going for quite some time. India is still moving north and east at a fairly high velocity. Not as fast as it used to be, but it's still fast enough that those mountains are continuing to go up. So, anyway, back to Proverbs 8. One thing I want to do next week as we get into this, or next week is the Skeptics Forum, isn't it? Okay, well, and I think the week after that I'm going to be in Tennessee and in North Carolina, so maybe 2 weeks from today. So we go through this text. Basically, you got the second person of the Trinity speaking. This is one of the great texts that I take Jews to, for example, to establish the doctrine of the Trinity, because you've got the Lord talking to another deity, and they're both claiming to be God. I was there with him. So that's kind of the theme you see all the way through. But what you're going to see is that the second person of the Trinity is literally taking credit for every detail of creation, saying, I was there when all this happened. You can kind of read down through the text starting in verse 22. And notice what happens when you get past verse 31. You got a therefore. Since I was involved so intimately every step of the way. Another great text is that this is where you can go to for the fine-tuning argument. Jesus here is taking credit for every single detail of creation, and the therefore is we can trust him. If he was that involved in creating everything, and it ends here with saying he delights in mankind. So he's basically telling us the story of creation over the past 3.8 billion years. God is transforming the earth, putting all these different life forms on earth. Why? So that mankind can come upon the scene and God is going to take great delight in him. Now, all the way through this text, it's saying that he was a craftsman at the side of God the Father. So here's God the Son and God the Father working together as craftsmen, delighting in everything that they do. But the greatest delight they get is when they bring human beings upon the terrestrial scene at the very end of the window of time for life here on planet Earth. And if you read the last five verses of Proverbs 8, it's telling us, if I've done all that, you can trust me with every detail in your life. That's kind of... I say that because a lot of people teaching this text, they stop at the end of the creation thing and they don't get to the therefore. If God is that much involved, and that's why I began this lesson with Hebrews 11:6. Anyone who comes to God must believe that he exists, and he rewards those who earnestly seek him. And so what Proverbs 8 is telling us is, this is why you can believe that I exist, not just that I exist, but I want you to see, as you look at the record of nature, just how involved I've been at each step of the way, carefully preparing everything so that you can come upon the scene where I can take great delight in you, and therefore you can trust me with every aspect of your life. And it begins by saying, listen to my instruction. My instruction is worth listening to. How do we know that? Look at what he's done in the record of nature. If he's that carefully prepared everything for us, then how much more is it wise to listen to our instruction? And hey, if the ant is wise in responding to everything the way God wants him to respond, all for our benefit, then how much more should we listen to his instruction? And once again, I think this is a wonderful text to go to where it links redemption with creation. If you go before verse 21, the topic is about redemption. If you go from verse 31 forward, it again comes to redemption. So this theme of creation is sandwiched between the introduction of redemption, and then at the end, it brings up redemption again. And apparently, even ants will fill a role in setting all that up for us. So, I'm out of time, but a couple of weeks from now, we'll get back to this. And I want to take you through this one verse at a time, so I encourage you to read the verses between now when we get back to this again, trying to keep in mind the redemption theme and the creation theme and why it is we can trust God with every aspect of his life and why we can know he's aware of every aspect of our life. It's kind of what we see in the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus talks about, hey, if a sparrow falls, my Father knows it. And don't worry about your clothing. Hey, look at the lilies of the field. If he cares that much to make sure they're beautifully clothed, how much more is he going to be caring for you? And therefore, don't be anxious. We need to trust him. He can take care of that. If he takes care of the ants, he takes care of us. But isn't it amazing that we live in a day and age where we can discover where all these pesky ants that we're worried about actually were created by God and placed there so we can be living in a time where there's regular ice ages that we can exploit to launch and sustain civilization. So, yeah, the ice is good. Anyway, we'll close with that. Father in heaven, I want to thank you for the fact that you have so carefully prepared this planet over the past 3.85 billion years of different life forms at different times. Lord, taking into account the changing physics of the sun, the moon, and the earth, and ensuring that our planet always has a maximal abundance of life, as we see in Psalm 24, as also we see in Psalm 104 and in Isaiah 45, that you created this planet to be full, to be maximally full, to be maximally diverse, all of it targeting us human beings. Thank you for all the preparation you've put into this planet and all of its life so we can exist here and thrive here. And Father, use everything that you've provided over the past 3.85 billion years to launch and sustain global high technology civilization. And Father, I pray you make us committed to use those resources, to use the civilization, the technology you put into our hands, to take the good news of Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world. And Father, to do it quickly, so we can be delivered from this creation and gain entry into the new creation, where evil and suffering will never exist again. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.